Fall calls for comfort. Mack Weldon's got essentials designed for cool days and timeless style. Their new Ace line combines comfort with sophisticated looks. Go to MackWeldon.com for 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code MACK25.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.
Greetings, everyone from Venezuela.
Are you in Miraflores?
I'm close by. I'm at one of the special government buildings, one of the historic buildings here. And as you can see, they're already getting ready for Christmas. Down below, there's the nativity and conferences happening, and everything is quiet and cool here, and things are good. Things are good. No complaints.
Our viewers are unaware. Christmas in Venezuela starts in October. I believe, and it lasts
in October, and it's already started
all the way to January. So it's one of the largest Christmas celebrations in the world. So
yeah, it's of course great.
We didn't even get to cover your trip to Burkina Faso before you jet set it off to Caracas.
I know. We're on the move. DD Geopolitics is all over the world, bringing it to you live and on the ground. So
yeah, you'll be in a war soon. Well, today, guys, we're going to cover this massive nuclear drill from Russia, the non-existent Budapest talks, and obviously a nice big update from Venezuela, getting a nice vibe check from Chris. So let's get started. We'll start with this nuclear drill. Aria put together this nice video for us so we don't have to tell you guys.
Сегодня под вашим руководством проводится тренировка по управлению стратегическими ядерными силами. Разрешите начальник генерального штаба генерала Андрей Герасимов Валерий Васильевич доложить замысел проведения тренировки.
Да. Добрый день, уважаемые товарищи. Сегодня у нас плановая тренировка по управлению ядерными силами, как только что доложил министр обороны. Давайте начнем работать. Пожалуйста, слово начальнику Генерального штаба Вооруженных сил Российской Федерации Герасимову Валерию Васильевичу. Прошу вас, Валерий Васильевич.
Товарищ верховный главнокомандующий, на тренировке предлагается отработать порядок действий по санкционированию применения ядерного оружия. Практические действия будут осуществлять подвижный грунтовый ракетный комплекс «Яд» Государственного испытательного космодрома «Плесет», ракетная подводная лодка стратегического назначения Северного флота «Брянск» из акватории Баренцевого моря, стратегический ракетоносный Ту-95 МС с аэродромом в районе.
On the heels of a flat-out refusal for the ceasefire from Russia, and we'll get to that a little bit later. Today, Rybakov came out with some statements regarding the nuclear disarmament calls that the U.S. has been making, saying that they're completely unrealistic, and that if the U.S. rejects the proposal, Russia's proposal on the New START treaty, the nuclear threat will grow. but Russia will still guarantee its own security. At present, there are no conditions for meaningful dialogue between the U.S. and Russia on non-proliferation. Moscow keeps the door open for political and diplomatic solutions on arms control. NATO's aggressive course risks a direct clash between the nuclear powers. The West should instead focus on finding negotiated solution around Iran's nuclear program, because there is no sensible alternative, and Russia will not be dragged into another expensive arms race.
A lot of developments, and I think that we have to see them in parallel. Of course, President Putin and the Kremlin were very adamant that this was planned before, because, of course, we just had the breaking news coming out of the Wall Street Journal, which maybe we'll cover later on. But we have that. We're dealing with questions still around Budapest. So there's a lot of concern on some corners of the info web. People asking, you know, is something going on? What's Russia doing? But this was a standard drill, and of course, it shows Russia's readiness to have its strategic nuclear forces on standby, always prepared to defend the Russian Federation.
I feel like there's a miscommunication going on between the United States and Russia, or maybe the United States is just telling the media one thing. But Lavrov and Rubio did have a call on Monday. Today's Wednesday. And it didn't seem to go that well.
Когда сейчас стало звучать из Вашингтона, что надо немедленно остановиться, не надо ничего больше обсуждать, остановиться, а там пускай истории рассудят. Ну, понимаете, если просто остановиться, это означает забыть про первопричину этого конфликта, который американская администрация с приходом к власти Дональда Трампа четко понимала и озвучивала это понимание. Я имею в виду обеспечение внеблокового, нейтрального, безъядерного статуса Украины, что предполагает отказ от каких-либо попыток втягивать ее в НАТО. И я имею в виду прекращение фактического геноцида русского и русскоязычного населения.
Another reiteration of the no ceasefire. I feel like I live in the movie Groundhog Day. I just said that to Aria earlier, but I don't know if he got the reference. But I feel like I'm reporting on the same statements like every stream. It's like we just want the same goals that we stated back in 2022.
And even before that, since 2014, that the root causes of the Ukrainian crisis of the junta that led to this fascist regime being propped up by the West, those root causes need to be addressed. And until they're addressed, which include denazification of Ukraine, neutrality of Ukraine, the rights of the Russian Orthodox Church and of the Ukrainian Church under the Moscow Patriarchate, the rights of the Russian-speaking people, the support and safeguarding of the history, values, culture, celebrating May 9th, an end to the decommunization that we've seen in the destruction of historical landmarks, even if they were from Soviet times. These issues have to be addressed. Until they're addressed, there is no negotiating or why would there be a ceasefire if these issues, because the Russians understand, if these still remain as open wounds, war will come again. War is bound to happen again. So they need to be addressed.
Do you think that the United States just doesn't understand the sentimentality and the almost emotional attachment to this conflict for the parties, because the United States kind of lacks their own emotional attachment?
I think the United States is cold and calculated here. I think they totally understand what's going on. They're not stupid. I mean, there's right-wing influencers and bloggers and people. I mean, Tucker went and did an interview with Putin and came to Russia. People know what's going on. They're not, but don't forget, it's a killer business right now. NATO countries have increased to 5%. And as they use weapons, they buy more weapons, which means that all of the stocks of these military-industrial complex companies do very well. What's to stop? Why stop? Why stop right now? Of course, you can BS the American public and the world public all you want by saying, oh, yes, you know, let's have a ceasefire and peace and stop the killing. If they wanted to stop the killing, the Trump administration in the first term wouldn't have given weapons to kill innocent civilians in the Donbass. And by the way, the Trump administration was the one giving weapons and training Ukrainian forces for 4 years in the first administration as well. So none of this peace president stuff has come to pass. So I think that needs to be understood, and I think the Russians are very sober about it. They want to keep a good relationship. But at the end of the day, they know that the American administration and that Trump himself is beholden to bigger interests and deeper interests than whatever he says in public. And they know that very well.
So yesterday, Russia, according to Reuters anyway, Russia reiterated the peace terms to the United States in a private non-paper. Russia sent this confidential diplomatic memo to the U.S. over the weekend, reestablishing its previous peace terms for Ukraine. I guess they're living in Groundhog Day, too. Their key demands were full Russian control over the entire Donbas region, rejecting Trump's proposal to freeze the front lines where they currently stand, and no NATO troops stationed in Ukraine under any framework, to which Trump replied like this.
The meeting with Vladimir Putin is canceled or put on hold. Do you know what happened there? And does that affect your decision whether or not to send Tomahawks?
No, I don't want to have a wasted meeting. I don't want to have a waste of time, so I'll see what happens. But we did all of these great deals, great peace deals. They're all peace deals. They're agreements, solid agreements, every one of them. But this one, and I said, go to the line of battle, the battlefield lines, and you pull back and you go home and everybody takes some time off because you got two countries that are killing each other. You got two countries that are losing 5,000 to 7,000 soldiers a week. So we'll see what happens. We haven't made a determination.
So no Budapest because it would be a waste of time.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the big things that we're following now closely is that there seems to be mixed signals coming out of the Kremlin and Washington. Washington seems to be like, it could be a waste of time. Meanwhile, the Kremlin and Peskov was saying, well, no, nothing's really been canceled yet. Even Zakharova emphasized that things are still, you know, there's still discussions ongoing. We'll see what ends up happening. We'll see.
What do you think?
I mean, I think. Listen, at this point, the Russians are advancing, like we said in our Sunday show. They're advancing on all fronts at this point, and they have the initiative. Zelensky is feeling the pressure more and more, and I think that the Russians would face also internal opposition if they were to stop all of a sudden now. I think the Russians are open to peace and open to negotiations. They always have. They're a responsible state actor. So in that sense, I think that they could meet again. But there are big concerns over how the logistics of it. You know, is President Putin's plane going to be down by the Poles? What's happening here? What's the route to be taken? There's a lot of other concerns. I mean, you're talking about the Russian Federation's president crossing the European border in this way. There are a lot of concerns to that. And I think that there's a lot bigger conversation to happen. Even if Orban can guarantee the safety of President Putin in Ukraine, Hungary, in Budapest, there's no talk of other countries and what they could do. And the European Union is putting tremendous pressure. So I think it's a wait and see at this point. But ultimately, we know the Americans and the Russians have the cards. If they want to do this, they can pull it. And we'll see what ends up happening.
I agree. And everything is very much still in flux. And we're not going to cover it on this episode because there's just not enough time. Maybe we'll cover it more in depth on Sunday. But there's multiple refineries being blown up outside of Russia and Ukraine. Today, yep. We saw one blow up in Bratislava. We have that kind of going on. And then right before we were about to start streaming, there was the announcement that the United States had lifted key restrictions on Ukraine's use of Western long-range missiles. Now, while this obviously won't be a game changer, this has to do more so with the storm shadows. They haven't made the decision on the Tomahawks yet. But like we discussed on Sunday, none of this is going to shift the balance or shift the scales of the war, I guess.
No, it won't change the outcome of the battlefield right now. And that's very much apparent. What they will try to do is try to pressure public opinion and try to force. I mean, if you have missiles starting to rain down on larger cities and especially in Moscow, which was the fear of the Tomahawks, I think that's going to change the dynamic. And there's going to have to be a much larger conversation as to the response of the Russian Federation. But no, I think that this is all, these are provocative acts, of course. But the Russian Federation will counter. And you see the nightly maps. I mean, the Russian drone production and use in the battlefield is enormous now. And it continues to advance at a record pace. So this is one for the history books at this point in terms of drone warfare and what the Russians can handle. I don't think a few missiles extending their range is going to change that.
Also, this was just announced.
So we are going to
either announce after the close this afternoon or first thing tomorrow morning a substantial pickup in Russia's sanctions.
Was that his APAC handler behind him?
I was about to say, who's that guy behind him with the nice hair?
More sanctions. So Russia, you're getting game changers, storm shadows, and game changer sanctions.
I'm grabbing my popcorn to see what Kirill Dmitriev is going to write on X. I'm looking forward to
Will he put up another AI of like a bear and an eagle hugging? That guy hanging out. He's hanging out with Anna Paulina Luna.
Yeah.
Anyway, now that we've gotten all of that out of the way, you're in Venezuela.
I'm right now in Venezuela.
The entire region is now in the crosshairs. We've started knocking on the gates.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Of Colombia, so let's talk about that first.
Well, the good news, Sean, is that in Colombia, the people support America. America supports the people of Colombia. They just have a moronic leader in charge right now. But there's an election next year, and I think that's going to go very differently. And our relationship with Colombia will be back on track after this guy's gone.
We're going to interfere with the election next year, guys.
You heard it here first.
So that's on the table. Don't forget. And as we talked about while the UN extravaganza was going on, Gustavo Petro has no fucks left to give. He was out protesting in the streets of New York. And this is his response to this.
Su misión no es cambiar a Trump.
No.
Su misión es buscar la mejor negociación posible para los millones de colombianos que dependen de esos empleos.
La humanidad tiene una primera salida y es cambiar a Trump. De diversas maneras. Puede ser por el mismo Trump. La más fácil. Si no, sácala a Trump.
Everybody wants to get rid of everybody. That's like... But it really gives no shits. But do you have any clue or any insight into what the political climate is like in Colombia right now? Their election isn't until last year. Petro's been very outspoken, but I'm not sure about public opinion inside of Colombia and how they feel about what's kind of going on with the tension in the region.
I mean, listen, Gustavo Petro has really turned himself into a populist firebrand and really making himself into a Colombian patriot, unlike the lapdogs of the U.S. that had governed for decades and decades before. So I'm here with a couple Colombians from different parties within Colombia, including the ruling party, and people are excited. They're saying his name. People are cheering, clapping, sloganeering. I mean, it's great to see. And there's a lot of support by Venezuelans of Colombia and Colombians of Venezuelans. So you're seeing also this, you could say this Bolivarian unity, because both countries actually were once one. And so you're seeing this sort of grand project of liberation and anti-imperialism and anti-fascism really materializing. The question, of course, is how long that can last under the threat of a U.S. Possible military action being taken against both governments. That remains to be seen. But the people here are on fire. Of course, people are on edge, but people are really ready to defend their country. And they feel like this is one of those historical moments, like the one behind me and all of the beautiful paintings in this beautiful government building, that Venezuela will once again, like Colombia, have to stand up against imperialism and tyranny.
Well, Lindsey Graham has plans as well.
I had a chat with you this weekend. I thought you had a pretty darn good idea. And you said you were going to share it with the president. I want to know if you did. And that is this opposition leader in Venezuela that won the Nobel Prize that said it really deserved to go to Donald Trump. Sounds like a pretty good leader to me for the people of Venezuela and the end of narco-terrorism and a better relationship with the U.S. Or if they choose maybe the 51st state, I don't know.
Sounds good to me, but the opposite.
51st state. We tried Greenland. We tried Canada. We tried Panama. Maybe we'll have better luck with Venezuela, 51st state. I would love a 51st state Venezuela. It wouldn't be good for Venezuela, but for my own selfish reasons, I would love a 51st state Venezuela.
I don't think the Venezuelans would approve, but why not? We'll see what ends up happening. The main thing is that I do have to say that being here right now, you do see an increased police and military presence. You see increased checkpoints, but there's a lot of military hardware out and people, you know, people are ready. You see a lot more people with the arms, with the training, with uniforms. So it's very good to see that people are ready. The people are ready to defend their country. And I don't think that the U.S. is going to walk in here. You remember, we're old enough to remember, of course, in 2003 in the buildup to the Iraq war, where they said, the American troops are going to be greeted with roses and flowers along the streets of Baghdad. And of course, that ended up being, as many commentators have said, strewn with bullets and IEDs. So I think that the U.S. should be very careful about how they project onto the Venezuelan people how they will greet the U.S. And if they will greet the U.S. as liberators or as another tyrannical force to be dealt with by the people.
So this next video, and I kind of like to, I'm showing it because I want to show some of the solidarity across the region. This is João. I always mess up that name. Pedro Stedile he's from the Landless Rural Workers Movement of Brazil. There we go. I was worried I was going to get that out. There we go.
Firmar um compromisso aqui em Caracas a los gringos. No se atrevan a entrar en Venezuela, que todos nosotros cerraremos fileras y estaremos con ustedes. Cuenten con el pueblo brasileño, con el pueblo de Guatemala, de Uruguay, los pueblos de Latinoamérica, estaremos con ustedes luchando hasta que el último marinero regrese a alguna tumba en su país imperial. ¡Viva Hugo Chávez! ¡Viva el pueblo de Venezuela! ¡Viva la unidad de los pueblos!
I guess
the energy is the same at this conference here right now, by the way.
You know what's funny is that I've been listening to people in spaces talk about Venezuela because they really don't know what to make of it. But they're like, you guys got to understand, these people are like communists. They're like radical communists. I'm like, you guys have no idea what.
And you know, even beyond that, they're not even radical communists. These people are proud patriots, and they basically say, we want to have our own dignity. We're a mosaic of a country made up of indigenous people, Afro-Caribbean people, and Europeans, and not to mention Arabs and all the ones who've come in since then. And I think that they really see that, you know, who the hell are these gringos to come and tell us what to do? And so they see that solidarity with a lot of other countries, including the Palestinian people. You see everybody wearing keffiyehs here and things like that. It doesn't have to be. They're not like, not everybody's a Marxist-Leninist here or things like that. Not everybody. But people are basically saying the countries of the world deserve their own sovereignty, their own independence. And by the way, this should be standard par for the course for libertarians in the U.S. and other right-wingers who believe in individual freedom and things. Doesn't that mean that every country has a freedom to do what they want, you know, and to kind of choose their path? So I think that this is also something that we can definitely harp on, that the Venezuelan people deserve their own path and they should not be told by the U.S. or by anybody else what to do. And that's being reiterated today at the conference that I'm at here, which is on anti-imperialism and anti-fascism and defense of the Bolivarian Revolution. And you see the imagery, and the imagery comes right through the years and right through the history.
I lost my train of thought. I had one and it went away. Anyway, so in that theme, Brazil comes out and it expresses its solidarity with Venezuela, and then Russia does it as well in their own way.
Мы говорим о том, что процедуры, которые необходимы для ратификации базового договора, не должны зависеть от каких-то внешних превходящих факторов. Мы никогда не скрываем, что мы вместе с Венесуэлой, и все это знают. Мы сейчас демонстрируем новый этап нашего сближения. Данный договор скоро вступит в силу. Я уверен, что вслед за ним у нас в
копилке взаимоотношений с Венесуэлой появятся и другие документы. Мы не должны работать на потребу, в кавычках, кому бы то ни было. Мы должны через собственное сотрудничество, партнерство и взаимопонимание повышать собственный ресурс для проведения нашей ответственной, полностью понятной, лишенной двойного дня на линии, на международной арене.
So, a more solidifying the Russia-Venezuela relations. Have you seen any evidence of Russia-Venezuela relations since you? I mean, your evidence of it, I guess. But have you seen?
No, I mean, yes, we have Russian guests right here at the conference I'm at. Members of different communist parties and also the United Russia Party. We're seeing, of course, a lot of Russian experts around. We see a lot of Russian planes at the airports. So I think it's very important to understand that Russia has a presence here. They've continued to defend Venezuela. I was here in 2019 when almost the whole airport looked like it had Russian planes, because at that time it looked like the U.S. was going to come in, if you remember, under the first Trump administration. Mm-hmm. So I think that Russia now has elevated their relationship to a strategic level. And I think that that means that there also will probably be a Russian military presence if there's not already one. I've heard that there already is one here. And that the Russians will continue to provide the Venezuelans with the advanced air defense technology, and also will continue to park nuclear-capable bombers when they come into the region, much to the chagrin of the United States.
So another article came out today. This is an exclusive from the Washington Post. Trump beats the drums of war for direct action in Venezuela. He has declared armed conflict with drug trafficking groups that he has designated international terrorists. He has also signed what is called a finding or an authorization document for CIA covert operations in Venezuela and charged Maduro with being illegitimately elected and heading a narcotics cartel. Asked if he had authorized the CIA to take out Maduro, Trump said, "It would be a ridiculous question for me to answer, but I think Venezuela is feeling the heat. He has made clear his intentions to go beyond blowing up boats, saying we're going to stop them by land." Several people familiar with the internal administration deliberations said any initial land attack would be targeted operation on alleged trafficker encampments rather than a direct attack to unseat Maduro. Having declared war against narco terrorists and designated Maduro as the head of at least one of them, quote, "there is really no turning back unless Maduro is essentially not in power. At the end of the day, if you have the authority to take out cartel runners at sea, you can take out the cartel boss." This is according to someone, an official inside the administration. Quote, "the U.S. is at a turning point. Washington needs to decide what it wants," said Jeff Ramsey, a Venezuela expert at the Atlantic Council. "The president came to office campaigning to end endless wars, but he's found himself now championing what may be America's longest war, which is the war on drugs." A couple months ago, I said that they would be combining the war on drugs with the war on terror. And that's sort of what we're seeing right here. And if you guys have noticed the rift that's developing inside the GOP with the ostracization of Thomas Massie, now the further ostracization of Rand Paul, neither of the two were invited to a special lunch yesterday. But Rand Paul had this to say about Trump's claims.
Number one, there is no fentanyl made in Venezuela. Not just a little bit. There's none being made in Venezuela. These are outboard boats that in order for them to get to Miami would have to stop and refuel 20 times. They're in all likely going to Trinidad and Tobago, which is an island right off of the coast of Venezuela. So there's a lot of reasons to be worried about this. But number one is the broader principle of when can you kill people indiscriminately? When you're at war. That's why when we declare war, it's supposed to be done by Congress. It's supposed to be thoughtful. It's supposed to be debated. And we're not supposed to do it willy-nilly. And then when you have war, you just kill people in the war zone. And even then, there are rules of engagement. But interdicting drugs has always been a criminal activity and a criminal anti-crime sort of activity where we don't just summarily execute people. We actually present evidence and convict them.
Once again, Rand Paul being one of the lone voices of reason amidst a sea of warmongers and, you know, bloodthirsty killers. And The truth is that we have now substantial evidence that's been accumulated, that's been gathered and now accumulated and sent to some international bodies, saying that many of these that were killed were just ordinary fishermen from even neighboring Colombia, some from Trinidad and Tobago. So we're seeing just the execution, even one boat having the international sign of distress, which is one motor lifted up. So there were two motors. One motor was lifted up, showing a sign of distress, and the U.S. still authorized a kinetic strike on it, killing some on board. I just think that what we're seeing now is not only extrajudicial killing. These are potential war crimes on the high seas. And by the way, some of which are taking place within the territorial waters of Venezuela, Colombia, and Trinidad and Tobago, which is a violation of their sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Don't you think we're just getting to the point where they're like, we're going to do what we want and you're not really going to have much of a say? And what happens then?
Yes, I think that we're at that point. And I think that that's the real fear here. I mean, the biggest fear that in talking to people here is that the United States will not do like an invasion. But what they will do is they will do targeted military strikes to try to decapitate the Venezuelan leadership and then to support various factions that might emerge in a power struggle. And that's the real fear, is that you could have a civil war type scenario, at which point the U.S. will use this strategy of tension and will try to benefit not only the reactionaries in the right wing, but also within the PSUV, also within the ruling party, to try to foment discord amongst maybe some generals that want to have their way. And I mean, after a big leader goes, there's going to be challenges for that. So I think that it's going to take on, for me, I'm thinking about Syria. In November of last year, and I'm thinking about the few Syrian generals that might have switched and how that might have changed the entire outcome. And so I think that probably some people are nervous that there might be some people in higher positions of power here that might be being groomed for the possibility of something like that to happen. It's happened before; it will happen again. So there's a real concern that the kinetic strike won't necessarily be a full blown invasion, but targeted killing of President Maduro and the leadership of the PSUV and the government. And that's a real fear that is taking hold from some people here, you know?
Right, but the opposition is terribly unpopular, thankfully. Even the opposition that the United States is propping up is terribly unpopular.
Of course.
And there's not a total economic breakdown like Syria was, so we do have that.
Correct. And that's why the people fear that the Americans and other outsiders will try to divide the ruling party, which has the most support, and try to use the factionalism there to try to foment some division. My hope is that the leadership, the senior leadership, including those below the executive and sort of the national administration, will continue to unify around their patriotic duty. And somebody will emerge as a leader through a wartime, should it happen. But we'll eventually see. I think the Venezuelan people are very resilient. And of course, they're people of dignity. And they won't allow this country to be destroyed and taken away from them like before.
Well, that's really all I have in terms of news updates. But what I want to do is encourage the viewers, since Chris is in Venezuela and a lot of you are Westerners, if you guys have stuff that you want to know or see, then let us know. Like, I want to see the grocery stores. We need at least one video of the grocery store, because people think that Venezuelans are literally starving right now. Venezuelans are starving. Palestinians are not. That's the reality that I live in the United States.
I know. It's crazy.
But anyway, what about your conference that you said it's anti-fascist and
anti-imperialist? So it's the World Anti-Imperialist Platform and the Simón Bolívar Institute. And it's overall great. And actually, I think we weren't on air yet, but I'd like to show everyone, just take a little bit of tour here. But you can see, the beautiful structure behind me. And then down below, you'll see the nativity scene with baby Jesus still not in the scene yet, in his crib, so to speak. Because, of course, the Venezuelans are getting ready for Christmas, and it's not even Halloween. It's still Halloween for us from the U.S. So we're here in late October, and they're already getting ready for that holiday. But, the beauty of this place, and I just want to take you on a little tour here. I mean, the beauty of this place is that Venezuela has a proud history and tradition. And you see these rooms just with paintings of all of the great leaders with beautiful marble busts of them. And you see, of course, at the end, the great Simon Bolivar. And I just want people to know that this is a country that has a very proud and rich history. It has a proud and rich history of defiance, and it will not allow itself to be taken over by a foreign power. It belongs to the Venezuelan people, the mosaic that they are, and it will continue to belong to them. And that's very important to understand. Venezuela has a unique identity, and that identity will continue to foster in the people a real profound sense of patriotism and loyalty, ultimately, to their flag, to their national symbols, to their history. And they will fight any invader, be it Spain or be it the United States, wants to come in and wants to enslave them once more. They won't allow it. They overthrew Spain to get their freedom. And they, I think, will fight the U.S. tooth and nail to make sure that they maintain that freedom and independence.
Well, Chris, I want to let you get back to your conference. We'll go through these super chats. Thank you, everybody, for watching. Will, thank you as always. Victoria Newland, as guilty as sin, fomented coup. Of course. Of course. The ghosts of Victoria Newland and Brzezinski and Kissinger will haunt us, I think, forever. And the Dulles brothers.
Yep.
I notice Russia is happy with murder. I don't know what that means, but if it's in regards to Jolani, go check out our new article on Substack about why Jolani was in Russia to begin with, which is pretty interesting. I didn't know that that was the case. Will you please marry me? I already did that once. I failed. Fool me once. Shame on you. Fool me twice. I will not be doing that again. But thank you so much for asking. Hopefully on Sunday, Chris won't be in the middle of a conference in the middle of a palace in Venezuela. So we'll work around it. But regardless, Chris, pick up a gun, get trained with the militia. We want all of the footage, all of the experience.
Let's go. I'm ready.
Grocery. And we will leave you guys with this hilarious RT video. Enjoy the rest of your work week, and we will see you guys on Sunday. Thank you all for watching. And go to DDGObama.com.
Do you ever catch yourself questioning more?
Like, why do I always parrot everything the U.S. State Department says?
Or why I always ask, do you condemn Hamas, but never Israel?
Why I never said sorry for spreading the debunked Trump-Russiagate hoax?
Why I support every illegal war the U.S. has launched this century?
Why I can't stop lying that Joe Biden was young and healthy enough for the presidency?
Why we ignore our rock-bottom ratings and pretend people still want to watch the same old bullshit?
The only reason we're asking
is because RT generated this video
and made us do it.
So you'll never get answers, at least not from us.
Happy anniversary to RT. I may be an AI, but there's no way I'm saying that.